This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And you know, you can listen to The Takeaway anytime by subscribing to our podcast. You can find that on our website, thetakeaway.org, or on iTunes. Obama on education, on community, and opening a can of...
We need to go back to the time, back to the day when parents saw somebody, saw some kid fooling around. And it wasn't your child, but they'll whoop you anyway.
In a whoop-ass speech before the NAACP, the president speaks of the past and the future. His sermon to a very sympathetic audience was a challenge, a congratulation, and a sales pitch for his legislative programs on education and health care. Barack Obama, the kid is not fooling around. We're going to whoop you anyway on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Friday, July 17th. I'm John Hockenberry, and I can actually remember that time when neighbors would whoop you for getting out of line. That happened in my neighborhood. Some thoughts about that in a moment. On the show today, we get deeper into the Comic-Con show out there in San Diego. It affects your life when it begins next week, believe me. And stimulus taking the wrong bus in Minnesota. Sarah Palin's comeback trail, we ask, is it a hike or an ice climb? But first, African-American Mayor Jerry Sam of Lamarck, Texas, joins us now. Good morning, Mayor.
Good morning.
You're the first African-American mayor, we should remind our listeners, of Lamarck, Texas, correct?
That's correct, and also of Galveston County.
And Galveston County, there we go.
That's
so you remember that time when if you got out of line, even a neighbor would whoop you, if you were, like what Barack Obama said last night? You remember that time, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I can remember the day that I was walking down the middle of the street. I had gotten in trouble at school, and the neighbor whooped me on the way going home, and then another neighbor whooped me, and then by the time I got home, my mom whooped me, and then my dad whooped me.
And Jerry,
I can promise you I never walked in the street again.
And Jerry, look how you turned out, right? Mayor of Lamarck, Texas in Galveston County. More with her in just a moment. First, everything you need to know this morning. In the headlines, at least eight are dead and dozens more wounded after dual suicide bombings of two luxury hotels in Indonesia. The Marriott and Ritz in Jakarta are popular with foreign travelers, including Americans. We'll find out how many new homes contractors are breaking ground on in just a few minutes. The latest report on new home construction is out this hour. Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor appears on track to punching her time card at the Supreme Court by early September and getting herself fitted for a robe. A full Senate vote on her is expected next month. She's expected to win every Democratic vote, plus some Republicans. Pope Benedict is in surgery with a broken wrist after a fall on vacation. The Vatican says he still managed to celebrate Mass after the fall. Wall Street continued a week-long rally today with major indices growing about 1%. There was good banking news all week long. There's more from Bank of America today. The Dow starts trading at 87.11. The S&P begins at 9.40. The NASDAQ kicks off at 18.85. In honor of Comic-Con and the weekend, we're shining our spandex suits here at The Takeaway, getting ready for all the superheroes that will be discussed at the Comic-Con conference in San Diego. So we're asking you, what's your favorite comic and comic book character? What about favorite comic book movie? Favorite movie made from a comic book character? And if you could have a superpower, what would it be? Greg in Staten Island emails us, if I had a superpower, I would love to be able to communicate telepathically with animals. Although sometimes I feel I do that already with my cats. Greg, thanks for sharing here on The Takeaway. You can do that at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Would they have thought on the day of the founding of the NAACP that 100 years hence there would be an African-American president addressing the centennial celebration of the NAACP in New York City, which is exactly what happened last night? We have three people here to talk about it. Rehan Salam is a fellow at the New America Foundation and editor of The American Scene. He joins us from Berlin, Germany. And you witnessed the speech this morning, correct, Rehan?
Yes, sure did.
And, of course, Farah Chidea, our friend, often co-host, queen of the zeitgeist, journalist, a friend of The Takeaway.
Hey.
Farah Chidea joins us. Good morning. And you were covering the speech last night.
Yeah, we did a special. The Takeaway did a special.
That's fantastic. And Geraldine Sam is the mayor of Lamarck, Texas, who we talked to at the top of the hour. She's on the line from her home in Lamarck, Texas, which is in Galveston County there. Geraldine, good morning once again.
Good morning.
What did you make of the speech last night? In many ways, the legacy that Barack Obama talked about of standing on giants is one that you can personally relate to.
Actually, I really appreciated his speech. I think that if I didn't know any better, I would have thought that he had stolen some of my speeches that I had given, because the speech that he gave was about no excuses. And so I really like that, because it's time out for blaming others for what we know that we should be doing as parents and what we in the community should be doing. For instance, myself, we'll say what our schools don't have and don't need. I didn't make an excuse. What I did was I called Oprah Winfrey on the phone, and they found me over $500,000 donations for my school. So,
well, there you
again,
go.
We've got to do our part.
It's about empowerment and about community. And here Barack Obama is extending, or at least attempting to challenge the NAACP to expand its vision in its next century.
Make no mistake, the pain of discrimination is still felt in America. By African-American women paid less for doing the same work as colleagues of a different color and a different gender. By Latinos made to feel unwelcome in their own country. By Muslim Americans viewed with suspicion simply because they kneel down to pray to their God. By our gay brothers and sisters still taunted, still attacked, still denied their rights.
Farah Chidea, this is the moment, really, where Barack Obama says, the past is past, but really the next 100 years is about broadening the civil rights agenda to include other groups. Do you think that message resonated in that hall last night?
I think that there was actually a quite delicate balance along the lines of what Barack Obama did during the campaign, because he also spoke at a different point in the speech about the slave castles in Ghana. His recent trip to Ghana included a trip to a dungeon above which there was a church. And he used that to a great applause line to say that isn't this hypocrisy to see people
saying one thing and doing another?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So I think that this was in some ways a rather distinct Obama speech, where he called for responsibility on the part of African-Americans locally, African-American leadership, but also said, look, there is structural inequality. He played both sides of that fence, and he did it with great rhetorical flourish.
Rehan Salam, is it credible to think that the civil rights agenda for African-Americans does broaden to issues of gays and issues of Muslims and the others that he talked about in the speech last night? Or does it remain more a series of categories and advocates who work for their own groups and don't necessarily embrace?
I think it makes a lot of sense, and I think it was very gutsy on his part. I think that a lot of American politicians have tried to speak differently to different audiences. This is one thing that, you know, people criticize the Clintons for example. You say one thing to a kind of conventional white liberal audience, you say another thing to an African-American audience. And I think that part of Barack Obama's rhetorical strength is that he really makes an effort to give the same message to every audience. So in this message, you know, rather than just trying to please conservatives or, say, liberals, he tried to challenge his audience in certain ways, while also, as Farah said a moment ago, linking together these structural questions with the idea of personal responsibility. And he embodies so much of this. I mean, he has this tremendous moral authority. As someone who is more on the right side of the political spectrum, there are many things I disagree with Barack Obama about. But these last two speeches, the speech in Ghana and also the speech to the NAACP, are things I think, you know, Americans across the political spectrum can really embrace, because it's him not so much as a political or partisan leader, but as a moral leader. And I thought it was really extraordinary.
All right, let's listen to him actually referring to some of those structural barriers that Farah talked about a moment ago.
The most difficult barriers include structural inequalities that our nation's legacy of discrimination has left behind. Inequalities still plaguing too many communities, and too often the object of national neglect.
Geraldine Sam, mayor of Lamarck, Texas, where are those structural inequalities most evident in your community?
It's most evident in our schools, and I would say when people are going to make loans at banks, those structural inequalities still exist. We have people that are, I mean, in schools especially, because actually I'm a teacher as well as a mayor, you see those all the time, because the school that I teach at is 90% African-American, but we don't have a lot of the things that you would see at other schools. And so those things are happening in today's world. And so I see it, again, over and over again with our young people. You see that they don't have the technological equipment that a lot of the other schools have. Other schools may have smart boards, but we're still using the regular books in the classroom, but yet we're expected to compete at the same level as other schools.
And the president, of course, talked a lot about education last night. You know, there is a question, not only in education, but also in healthcare, of a sense of deliverables that African-Americans and other constituencies are soon going to begin demanding. Here's the president talking about healthcare last night at the NAACP speech.
We know that even as spiraling healthcare costs crush families of all races, African-Americans are more likely to suffer from a host of diseases, but less likely to own health insurance than just about anybody else.
Farai Chidea, where does that translate politically into votes and to pressure on senators for the legislation that is very much on the table right now?
Well, I could give you a couple of answers. The first one is that I think that senators are concerned about reelection, and the ones who are up for reelection who have black people in their district will be very concerned if Barack Obama is getting folks all excited. But I think that this was meant to transcend the immediate practicalities and really frame Barack Obama as a health care reformer. He has been using health care in his personal missives that you get by email to do fundraising. And so when Barack Obama was speaking about healthcare, he was doing a few things: talking to the audience in the room, talking to the audience on TV, talking to Capitol Hill, and talking to people who can give him money.
Rahan, was this a stump speech on any of the legislative agenda, in your view?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think that, as Farai just said, I mean, I think that this, he was speaking to multiple audiences in a sense, and so he is trying to, you know, beat this drum so that he can gain some momentum. And he's stumbled a bit in terms of trying to sell his healthcare approach. But I think that it was a very shrewd move, because he has a deep and profound connection to this constituency. And, you know, even if his popularity erodes with other constituencies, he's going to have this as a solid base. So he wants to use it in such a way as to actually make forays to kind of hold on to that broader middle-class base.
Finally, Farai, you know, it struck me, and you mentioned that he talked about going to Ghana and experiencing the slave trade.
Right.
You know, he is not descended, though, in the same way as most of the people in that room are from the slave experience and the slave identity in the United States. And particularly when he referred to his mother keeping him on track and giving him the opportunity, that was a white mother. So I'm wondering how Barack's experience is special from the people in that audience versus being more embracing and being a part of the NAACP.
Well, I think that, you know, I would actually make the link to Michelle Obama.
He certainly did.
He made a point of saying, you know, the next Barack Obama and the next Michelle Obama, because he was someone who made a point of saying he was a guy from the south side of Chicago, which he's not. He's from Hawaii. But Michelle is. And Michelle is descended from lines of African Americans. I think they have blended these identities, African, white, African American, as they move forward. And he has taken on a bit of hers.
Rehan Salam, quickly, can he give this speech again, or does it begin to get redundant and sing-song and deliverables are about what the Obama administration needs to look at now?
I think this is exactly what it's going to be remembered for in 20, 30 years, his ability to communicate with this community in a very frank and open and tough-minded way.
All right, Rehan Salam and Farai Chidea, thanks so much for being a part of The Takeaway. And Geraldine Sam is the mayor of Lamarck, Texas, one of those African-American leaders that Barack Obama said stands on the shoulders of giants in the civil rights struggle over a century of the NAACP. Thanks to all of you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. You know me as meek, mild John Hockenberry. But in my comic book form, I am Radio Man. Yes, flying across the universe in my jet-powered wheelchair, saving people from themselves wherever I go. Perhaps I should start just working on myself, right? What superpower would you like? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and let us know, or mytake at thetakeaway.org. It's in honor of the Comic-Con conference, which starts next week out in San Diego. It's absolutely huge. Elizabeth Rapp writes the blog Geek Beat for Cinematical.com. Now, you're packing your bags and heading out to the Comic-Con conference, that show in San Diego, even as we speak, right? Three words for you, Elizabeth Rapp. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Oh, yeah. Getting ready, trying to organize my schedule, and heading out there, it's nerve-wracking.
And let's talk for 1 minute about just how huge this conference is. Who's joining you there in San Diego?
My other co-writers on Cinematical, Todd Gilchrist and Kevin Kelly, will be out there covering it with me, along with probably the rest of the entire competing for spots.
Well, there'll be the comic industry there. There's the sort of literary world there, because graphic novels are huge. And the movie world will be there, because, of course, some of the best films and biggest blockbusters in Hollywood are generated from the interest in comics. Elizabeth, hold on there. We're going to talk a little bit more about this. But Jeff Yang also joins us, friend of The Takeaway, Asian pop columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle and editor of Secret Identities. Jeff Yang, are you going to be at Comic-Con this next week?
I am indeed. I'm already on the West Coast, in fact.
Explain to people who maybe aren't quite so into it why the audience at Comic-Con is so valuable to makers of movies and Hollywood screenwriters.
You got to think of this as being kind of almost a hand-picked audience for the biggest tentpole movies, the kind of pop culture events of the calendar. This is the biggest pop culture show in the world. It's not just about comics, you know. It's not even, for that matter, just about geeks, as it were. I mean, this began as kind of a geek stock, if you will. But this is now the event that people plan an entire year for, literally, to get the buzz out about the sort of special effects-laden kind of science fiction, fantasy, high concept entertainment that's going to be taking us through the rest of the summer.
And the common thread here is, you know, maybe it begins with comics, as you say, but the common thread is these are first adopters. These are people who consume lots and lots of entertainment products, from games straight through to movies. And they love to be immersed for hours at a time in entertainment. So in a sense, they are the perfect focus group for Hollywood.
This is absolutely correct. I mean, it is amazing the stamina of the people who attend this thing. We really are talking about a group that is virtually recession-proof. All the other things, all the other events that have kind of had to fade in the background a little bit, you know, given the economic state of the world, Comic-Con is bigger than ever. This is an event that only sells registrations online, and it's sold out within days
right,
of announcing them.
Well, among the very highly buzzed events at Comic-Con this year are rollouts of the movies Astro Boy and G.I. Joe. Here's some selections from both trailers here in a moment.
Good morning, son.
Dad?
How do you feel?
Kind of weird.
Technically, we don't exist. We answer to no one. And when all else fails, we don't.
What did you say your unit was called?
I didn't.
Elizabeth Rapp, are you looking forward to Astro Boy and or G.I. Joe? Of course, these are movies generated from either comic books or toys.
Not so much either of those, although G.I. Joe looks fun for a midnight movie kind of thing. Who knows?
But Jeff Yang, at Comic-Con and among this particular audience, it's not so much the storyline that is of interest, although that is of interest. It's definitely the special effects. You referred to it a moment ago. These are the kind of graphic stylings of movies nowadays, and Comic-Con reviews special effects as much as it reviews anything.
Oh, yeah, totally. And from my perspective, of course, you know, sit with my geek hat on, those are two movies that I have all sorts of nostalgia from childhood. So, I've got to say I'm kind of looking forward to them.
There's also the Cameron movie Avatar, which is expected finally to be out.
Oh, yes. That, you know, in part because this is a movie that will, you know, speaking of special effects, it promises to redefine the way we think about the film experience. And so from a technical perspective, you got all sorts of people wondering what Cameron has up his sleeve. It's also something that's been worked on for 14 years. And, you know, in all of its different iterations, he's kind of been, you know, showing a little leg here and there, but no one really knows what he's going to unveil. And every time James Cameron has unveiled something of this scale, it has kind of broken and remade Hollywood. So, you know, I think everybody, not just the sort of science fiction fans, are looking forward to see what he has.
And among the list of films that are going to be floating out, you've got Iron Man 2, Tron 2, I mentioned G.I. Joe, The Hobbit is coming out. And the comics side of things, Elizabeth, I really am enjoying this Western comic that is all the rage. And describe, first of all, the character of Jonah Hex and where he comes from.
A series that DC did in the 70s called Weird Western Tales, I believe. I could have this wrong, but that's where he originated. He's the focus of a new movie coming out next year. Very cool character, sort of Clint Eastwood, High Plains Drifter kind of guy that kind of one foot in the grave, one foot on Earth.
It's sort of a post-Civil War kind of Cormac McCarthy thing.
Oh, yeah, very much. It's very gritty, very, very creepy. I mean, he fights, you know, he does the whole bounty hunter thing, but then sometimes he has to fight some creatures of the other world, as it were. The buzz on the movie is really interesting, very cool, and I'm really curious. This will be the first time that there will be footage from the film, and I'm really anxious to see it. It's got a great cast.
All right, well, the comic character is Jonah Hex, and Elizabeth Rapp writes the blog Geek Beat for Cinematical.com. She's going to be in San Diego, where Comic-Con begins next week. We're going to check in with you next week. Also with you, Jeff Yang, Asian pop columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, who is on the West Coast all ready for Comic-Con. And as for superpowers, Ibrahim, our own Ibrahim, says, my power, I would want the power to teleport from one place to another. That would be so convenient. Femi, okay, you've got the headlines?
I certainly do. Where are we? 29 minutes past the hour. Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor is one step closer to her confirmation after wrapping up 4 days of Senate confirmation hearings. The Senate Judiciary Committee is now set to vote on her nomination Tuesday, although it may be delayed another week. A full Senate vote is expected in August. In international news, in Iran, security forces have used tear gas and batons to break up crowds of opposition demonstrators during Friday prayer at Tehran University. And that comes as leading opposition cleric Ali Akbar Hashimi Rafsanjani called for the release of those jailed during the protests. And in Afghanistan, 11 civilians are dead after a roadside bomb shredded a vehicle in southern Afghanistan. The victims were on the way to a shrine. That is a look at some of the big stories making headlines this morning. John?
Thank you, Femi. Coming up, a story of how stimulus money got on the wrong bus in Minnesota.
We'll
explain in a moment.
All right, I'll stay tuned.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. A bit of a boom in the housing industry. Numbers just coming in now. We'll report on them a little bit later. But both the housing starts and building permits are up, and it's more than analysts expected. And also, we've been following story in Jakarta, Indonesia, where the death toll has stood all morning at least 8. Bombings rock the central business district. You hear some of the reaction there from Jakarta. Targets were 2 luxury hotels, both American-owned. Many people were injured, as many as 50, some reports are saying. Daniel Zeev, writer and filmmaker and author of Jakarta Inside Out, who was in Jakarta this morning when the bombing took place, rejoins us now. Anything new to report on claims of responsibility or a sense that this fits some sort of pattern that we've seen in East Asia before?
No specific updates in terms of actual claims of responsibility, John, but it definitely fits the pattern of sort of very targeted attacks on symbols of Western power or luxury. That was the case in the bombings here in 2002, 2003, and 2005.
And Daniel, how can the government rule out the timing of this bombing with the election campaign that was just concluded in Indonesia? Oh, we seem to have lost Daniel Zeev, who witnessed, at least close to the central business district in Jakarta this morning, the bombing of 2 American-owned hotels, the Ritz-Carlton and the JW Marriott. The death toll stands at least 8. As we mentioned in the last segment, we're going to take a look at the stimulus package. We've been watching it ever since it began its journey from Washington to the rest of the country. And think back, it was all hope and excitement in St. Cloud, Minnesota in March when Mr. Economic Stimulus himself, Vice President Joe Biden, showed up in St. Cloud to announce that a big chunk of the $8.4 billion in infrastructure stimulus money would be coming to the town.
We want to invest not just in getting people jobs right now. What we want to do in addition to that is lay a foundation for the 21st century, lay a foundation in areas that are going to allow us to grow in ways that will allow us to continue to lead not only in America, but lead the world.
Joe Biden was in St. Cloud to say that the best place to invest was in the bus company that forms one of the major industries in St. Cloud. But that was then, and now the hope and excitement in St. Cloud have been replaced by some questions. Here's resident Ronald Rosedahl speaking just yesterday.
He promised this money way back in last November, and here it is August or July, and I haven't seen anybody that's making any money off the stimulus. I don't see people working that are getting stimulus money. You know, it's not helping anybody.
Should I give up, or should I just keep chasing?
Chasing pavements for us, and the perfect person to get to the bottom of this apparent discrepancy is Andrea Bernstein, our takeaway correspondent, who follows infrastructure and the shovel-ready stimulus money all over the United States. With her is Ambar Espinoza, a reporter from Minnesota Public Radio. Good morning, Ambar.
Good morning, John.
And good morning, Andrea. So why the discrepancy? Why does it take so long to get money from point A to point B?
Well, unfortunately or fortunately, as the case may be, the United States is not China. They just put $500 billion into their infrastructure and it went right in. The stimulus bill, as we've been talking about, is an appropriations bill. And it has to go through state governments and it has to go through the states. And the money takes a long time to get contracted and to get out there.
And you experienced that in, you know, great detail, reporting on what's going on in St. Cloud, Ambar Espinoza. You actually spoke with that Ronald Rosedahl, who we heard his voice just a moment ago. Are people getting impatient, or are they willing to sit tight for a while?
No, you're right. You're sensing that people are getting impatient, and that is the case for Mr. Ronald Rosedahl and also other people I spoke to. In his case, he's been unemployed for 2 years, and he's having a really hard time finding work in St. Cloud, and that was the common theme that I heard among many different people whom I spoke with in downtown St. Cloud.
Well, let's listen to some of those voices. And really, at the center of all this is the hope that they might get a job as a result of stimulus money going to this bus company. Explain what it does and why it is such a focus of hope. Ambar?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were talking to Andrew. Could you repeat the question, please?
Sure. It's the voices that we spoke with, and you spoke with a bunch of people in St. Cloud, are focused on the possibility that this one particular plant, this maker of buses in St. Cloud, is going to get the stimulus money and ripple through the local economy there. Explain.
You're right. There's a mixture of pessimism and optimism. A lot of people whom I spoke with said that they're hesitant or they're doubtful that they could even get a job at New Flyer because they don't have the training to assemble buses. One man said that he would need to get a welding certification and he didn't have the time or the money to do that. Then there's other people like a woman I spoke with. Her name is Misty Odell, and she is homeless right now, but she still expressed a sense of hope that there might be maybe not a welding job for her at New Flyer, but something else. And here's a clip.
From people's perspective, they don't see this stimulus money actually helping them because they don't see how they could get a job there.
Well, there's got to be, like, people that clean the place. There's got to be, like, people that do paperwork and take orders, you know, stuff like that. So, I mean, it could be a range of jobs. And on, like, an assembly line, I mean, I'm sure it would be easy to train in, right?
Ambar Espinosa, what evidence is there at the plant level that money is in the pipeline somehow?
Last month, I visited the plant in St. Cloud, and I was able to speak to the vice president of operations. And at that time, he could only disclose that he had two confirmed contracts as a direct result of the stimulus, and that was Chicago and Philadelphia. And most recently, I spoke to Metro Transit Systems in Minneapolis and Cleveland, and they confirmed that they also purchased buses through stimulus money. So the money, the contracts are definitely coming in, but it's moving slowly, and the company hasn't announced publicly the majority of the ones that are coming in. They should be announcing it shortly. I was told last week by the company that they would be announcing it this week, but so far I haven't seen anything.
Right. Ambar Espinosa, reporter for Minnesota Public Radio there in St. Cloud. Andrea Bernstein, is this emblematic of the kind of slowdowns and difficulties of getting the stimulus into places that can actually hire people?
Absolutely. The president was hoping that he could gin up enough confidence by having the stimulus bill to get people spending and to get the economy moving. But what's happened, at least with the unemployment, is that people are still waiting for these contracts to come in, and it's going through these processes, and it's very, very slow. There's a lot of frustration. It may be another year before the full effects of the jobs from the stimulus bill really are seen.
I guess the question is, does that end up muting the confidence that is so politically necessary for Barack Obama?
Well, the 2010 elections are looming
yes,
on the horizon,
indeed.
So I'm sure they'll be doing everything they can.
There's some stimulus. Andrea Bernstein, takeaway correspondent, focusing on all the shovel-ready issues in the economy. Femi Okeh has some quick headlines here.
Thank you. 20 minutes to the top of the hour. Just getting a new economic indicator out. The number of new houses built last month jumped 3.6%. That's its highest level in 7 months. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is travelling to India today. It's part of an Asian trip that also takes her to Thailand. And it's her first overseas trip since breaking her elbow last month. And a little bit of sport for you just to wrap up. In Scotland, it's day two of the British Open. It's in progress right now. And Japan's Kenichi Kaboya tops the leaderboard. That's
all right.
For your news.
A look at some hiding headlines in a minute.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. First, it was Goldman Sachs this week with a report of $3.44 billion in revenue. Now today, Bank of America reports $2.42 billion in profit. We're also getting reports that Citigroup, the huge troubled bank that's been emblematic of all that's wrong in the financial industry, possibly earned $4 billion, although there's some difficulties even measuring what goes on at the huge Citigroup. Joining us now is Marshall Ekblad, banking reporter for Dow Jones Newswire. He's on the line right here in New York. First of all, Marshall, it's been a banner week for the banks in terms of year-to-year comparisons, but even the raw numbers show this is serious cash. This is suddenly a business to get into.
Yeah, certainly the top line numbers at most large financial firms coming in have been good.
Now, there's something really disturbing to me in the Goldman number and specifically the Bank of America number. Both companies suggested, I mean, in the case of Goldman, it was record results for underwriting, basically the encouraging of trading and stock. For Bank of America, they also made an enormous amount of money from trading profits. Now, it seems to me that what Bank of America, which received an enormous amount of money from the TARP, the Federal Treasury, did was take low-interest federal money and trade it up.
Well, there have been accusations that the firms have been doing that. Certainly, it's not against the rules. It's important to remember that, I think, banks trading businesses, they don't just trade for the bank itself, but they trade for clients. And with the fall of especially Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns, there are fewer competitors in the marketplace. And so especially large institutions like pensions and corporations that need to trade stocks and bonds every day, there are fewer places to go, and that's certainly driving up profits at all of the large Wall Street firms.
But politically, this suggests that the best business to be in is the hedge fund business, the trading business. It's not in increasing liquidity into the economy and helping mortgage owners and people at the other end of this whole economic downturn.
There's no doubt that even as trading profits are up, credit problems are still on the rise, especially in commercial loans or loans made to businesses. On the other hand, one could argue that because of the higher trading profits, again, from serving, especially clients, that's putting some more money in the pockets of the bank, and that's money that's not coming from the taxpayers this time, and that in turn should encourage some lending down the road. But
that's the trickle down. That's the trickle down theory. I mean, I'm not ascribing that to you necessarily, but I guess on that point, is there any evidence that these profits shorten the time whereby Bank of America might repay the $45 billion in bailout funds it's received?
Well, there's been a long complaint about, the largest firms, that they are simply too big. And really the way that Bank of America turned a profit in this quarter was by selling a fairly large chunk of itself. It sold more than $9 billion in businesses and investments, $5 billion of which was big stake it held in a Chinese construction bank.
Huh.
And in some ways, that's, some people would say that's good news. The banks are getting smaller, and even if they're turning a profit by getting smaller, that certainly helps.
Right.
That helps get some of them down to size.
Well, good news in the banking industry, and something to look forward in the next quarter, where some toxic mortgages may come due and affect earnings for the next quarter. But Marshall Eckblad, thanks so much. Banking reporter for Dow Jones Newswire, reporting on Bank of America's $2.42 billion profit.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining whether states have the right to legislate the foods and restaurants that people choose. Is it a responsible way to make communities healthier, or does it violate freedom of choice? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here. Haven't heard much from Mark Sanford or Sarah Palin this week. Next week could be another story. We'll find out right after headlines with Femi Okeh.
Add almost 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning. Supreme Court hopeful Sonia Sotomayor appears to have a clear path to joining the High Court in early September. A full Senate vote looks likely next month, just before the Senate takes its summer break. Sotomayor is expected to win every Democratic vote, plus some Republican support. A House bill to overhaul the health care system now has a key new endorsement. The American Medical Association, the large doctors' lobby, says that it's backing the measure. But this comes as the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says that Democratic health care bills won't meet President Obama's goal of slowing down rising medical costs. Pope Benedict is out of surgery after breaking his wrist in a fall on vacation. The Vatican says that he still managed to celebrate Mass and have breakfast before going to the hospital. He's expected to stick to his planned schedule through the weekend. Iranian security forces and opposition protesters are in new clashes. Witnesses say that demonstrators were met with tear gas and batons at Friday's prayer services. And opposition presidential candidate Mir Hussein Mousavi appeared there, and it's his first public appearance for some time. And that is a look at some of the big stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi. So Sarah Palin is going to resign next week as governor of Alaska. We know all about this, but she may roll out a whole new life for herself. And what about Mark Sanford? He's still governor of South Carolina, yet does he face a confrontation when the legislature greets him on return from vacation with his wife? We can probably assume he's not vacationing in Buenos Aires this time. But there's a lot on the table in Washington also that's going to be the subject of confrontations next week, and we want to take a look ahead. Joining us is Julie Mason, White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner and friend of The Takeaway, joining us from Washington. Good morning, Julie.
Good morning, John.
And Erica Bolstad is a reporter for the Alaska Daily News. She's also in Washington, D.C. Good morning, Erica.
Good morning.
And also, Mark Quinn, the Mighty Quinn, host of South Carolina ETV and Radio's public affairs program, The Big Picture, joins us from Columbia, South Carolina. Thanks for coming back, Mark.
Hey, good to talk to you, John.
Let's start with the Sanford story. Where is the governor, and what is he likely to face when he returns next week?
We do not know where the governor is. He's in an undisclosed location, vacationing with his wife. Step one to what he says will be falling back in love with Jenny Sanford. I don't know if that sounds like a vacation to you, but nobody seems to know where he's going to be until next week. When he returns, it doesn't look as if he's going to face an awful lot of opposition. You know, there were a lot of calls for his resignation, but after there were some criminal probes, after the state law enforcement division looked into the matter in his trip to Buenos Aires, it was found that he broke no laws, and it doesn't seem to be any sort of stomach to call for him to step down in a more formal way. So I don't know. It's obviously not the end of the story. But at least for right now, all of that talk of him leaving office has died down to a large degree.
Very interesting. And perhaps the GOP in South Carolina doesn't have the stomach for a kind of Blagojevich-style confrontation played out in the national media, which suggests, what is the GOP's view, Erica Bolstad, of Sarah Palin's apparent media rollout that includes a book, speaking engagements, and an official resignation event next week? Erica?
I don't think anyone knows what to think of what she's doing right now. It's been incredibly confusing to watch her in Alaska for the general public, let alone any political party.
But, describe the events. I mean, her expectations are that she's going to come back and actually begin the writing of a book. She's going to begin a speaking tour that may or may not be worth $60,000 a pop, right?
Yeah, I don't think we really know exactly what we're going to see her do next other than the book. I think for the foreseeable future, she's going to be doing a lot of the kind of things on a different level than Governor Sanford. She's going to be probably reconnecting with her family. And I think in this case, she truly actually means that when she, often politicians say that they want to spend more time with their family, but I think in this case, Governor Palin is probably really truly wants to spend that time with her infant son and the rest of her family right now.
Julie Mason, Washington Examiner White House correspondent, do you think the GOP there in Washington would be pretty happy to have Sarah Palin spending lots and lots of time undercover
not.
With her family?
They really want her to go away. I can see her coming back as sort of a Lou Dobbsian type angry populist figure and helping to sort of whip up the grassroots. But the establishment here, they are not interested in her. You know, she had an op-ed this week in the Washington
right.
Post that was received with curiosity, but not really great fanfare.
And I guess the question, if you add Mark Sanford into the picture, Julie Mason, the symbols of leadership in the GOP right now are few and far between, and the high-profile ones are a little terrifying.
I know the party can really use a little help. And then we see recently, you know, in just some little informal polling that Mitt Romney is their guy again. He's sort of going to be their fallback, their go-to guy. And they're really a party casting about for some strong new leadership. They can really use it.
Well, Gail Collins of the New York Times said to us, actually, I think as recently as last week, there's Mitt Romney just waiting, knocking at the door, ready to come in,
yeah.
Or, you know,
he,
just packed
looks
and
more
ready.
Like Ronald Reagan every day,
every
John.
Day, indeed. Mark Quinn, Mark Sanford is going to continue as governor at least for another week. If there's no stomach for an opposition, what does this do to issues like funneling stimulus money into projects, dealing with the economy in South Carolina?
John, that's a terrific question. I mean, most of the nation's governors right now as we speak are down in Biloxi, Mississippi, trying to hammer out some of these problems that every state is facing. But ours is facing problems almost worse than anybody, with the exception of California and New York. The nation's third highest unemployment rate, and it's not getting any better in terms of trying to get some of that stimulus money funneled through that he blocked for the entire time. That's still hung up in an awful lot of ways. So his inability to work with the legislature over the last few years has been pretty famous. Now, I think there's still no telling exactly what kind of leadership right. He's going to be able to exact. I don't think any at all, quite honestly.
Well, let's go around the horn with all three of you on what I think was a moment last night at the NAACP convention for Barack Obama. It was a thrilling sort of emotional moment, noting the century of the NAACP. Yet it seems on some level implicitly to mark an end of the rhetoric and time for deliverables on the part of the president. And I'm wondering if, as we go forward now on health care and some of these other issues, politically and listening to your listeners, Mark Quinn, do you think people have confidence that Barack Obama can deliver on some of this stuff? And then we'll get a comment from everybody else.
I can tell you that there was extremely high expectations 3-4 months ago. I have noticed here lately, and I will say just in the last month, that the tone and tenor has changed. And even the very ardent supporters have become much more cautious in their tone. Not disappointed so much as they are just a little bit worried that perhaps he won't be able to deliver near as much as was promised, or at least as was hoped.
Erica Bolstadt, Alaska Daily News. What's track it for us from the perspective of people in your state?
Well, you know, in August, the Alaska State Legislature is going to be meeting to talk about. They're meeting for one day, a special session, and among the things that they're going to be talking about actually is overriding Governor Palin, who at that point will be the former governor. Her veto of one little piece of the stimulus package that came to Alaska, which is about $26 million in money for energy and other money that will go toward
infrastructure
programs,
programs
keep people's homes warm, basically.
Right, right, right.
So,
and they're getting with
so
the program in Alaska. That's what's going
right,
on
right.
There.
It takes a while for things to catch up out there.
And Julie Mason, take us out. What do you think? The tone of Barack Obama, can it deliver some of these things?
Well, you know, we've seen a real shift in tone, John, in the past week. These polls showing a drop since February among Americans who believe Obama has leadership skills. Really seeing the White House trying to respond to that. He's getting more forceful, more aggressive, and assertive on his policies. But well, it may be too late. I think people are really losing faith. He still has strong support, but it's slipping.
Well, definitely something to watch. Thanks to all three of you. Julie Mason, White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner. Mark Quinn, host of South Carolina ETV and Public Radio's The Big Picture. And Erica Bolstad, reporter for Alaska Daily News. Thanks, guys.
To the Batmobile. Let's go.
Comic-Con happens next week. We're taking a very close look at that here on The Takeaway. And in honor of Comic-Con, we want to know, what's your superpower? What is your favorite comic book character? And what about comic book movie made from a comic book? If you could have a superpower, what would it be? Power of accelerated healing, so you don't have to worry about paying for health care?
Hey, Troy from Dakota. I'm a songwriter, and I never have time to write and record all that I compose in my head while I'm working or whatever. So if I had a super ability, it'd be that I could just directly translate all those musical thoughts right into a compact disc.
All right. Our friend Jay already has a superpower. He doesn't have to sleep. He's been awake for the last 2 years. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, our sports guy, writes on the site, I want to teleport from one place to another. What's the problem there? Traffic? Give us a call with yours at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And where do you get your superpower comic book suit pressed? Let us know. I actually need to know, because mine is always getting wrinkled. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
At the Sotomayor hearings yesterday, first there was this.
Good morning, Justice Judge Sotomayor.
Senator Grassley mistakenly calls Judge Sotomayor a justice, as though she's already confirmed. Then, for Senator Sessions, the wheels really come off.
Senator Leahy and I are talking during these hearings. We're going to do that crack cocaine thing that you and I have talked about before. We got to.
Thank you, Senator. I appreciate
it. I want to restate that.
You may want to be. Let me correct the record.
Please rephrase it, Senator.
I'm just a regular guy with a business that's thriving. Because it's hard to make it in this life. It's a world of heartache and pain.
Please rephrase it, Senator. Please rephrase it, Senator.
No way to rephrase it. Judge Sonia Sotomayor is headed for confirmation. No, we can't vote on it. We're not senators. We're a radio program. The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Friday, July 17th. I'm John Hockenberry. Incredible. Jeff Sessions is a rapper. No, but besides a serious look at the Sotomayor hearings, we've got to look at what else President Obama was doing while in town for the NAACP speech. He was actually saving a governor in trouble across the river in New Jersey, along with an update on the scandal at the graveyard in suburban Chicago. We're going to take a look at that. But Takeaway pal Todd Zwillick is here. Todd, aside from those chuckle-headed moments in the Senate Judiciary Committee that I just showcased, there is there something that could keep this from being a confirmation for Sonia Sotomayor?
Well, it doesn't look like it anymore. All throughout the week, you're watching for those moments to see if any of the attacks on the judge are going to stick. Jeff Sessions, the ranking Republican, comes out yesterday, says he expects a vote by early August. That means no filibuster.
Well, we're going to talk about those details in just a moment. And Todd, you've been knocking yourself out this week. Thanks so much, buddy.
Oh, you know I live for it, John.
More with Todd Zwillick in just a moment. And everything you need to know this morning in the headlines, new home construction at the highest level in a full 7 months. 3.6% jump is higher than forecasters expected. Contractors don't break ground unless they think they can sell the house. So it could be a sign that housing is bouncing off the bottom. At least 8 are dead, dozens more wounded after dual suicide bombings of 2 luxury hotels in Indonesia. The attackers checked in as guests. The Marriott and Ritz in Jakarta are popular with foreign travelers, including Americans. Pope Benedict is out of surgery after breaking his wrist in a fall on vacation. He's expected to stick to the rest of his planned schedule. The Pope is 82 and has generally been healthy since taking over the Vatican 5 years ago. Iranian security forces and opposition protesters are in new clashes. Witnesses say demonstrators were met with tear gas and batons around Friday prayer services. It appears the opposition presidential candidate was there, his first public appearance in some time. Wall Street continued its rally yesterday, although the futures trading suggests a lower opening when Wall Street opens in about a half an hour. The Nasdaq kicks off at 1885. Feeling like a superhero heading into the weekend? I certainly do. Comic-Con starts next week in San Diego, the biggest summit of pop culture in America. We want to know from you, what's your favorite comic book character and comic book hero?
Larry Kessel from Down the Shore, New Jersey. And the best comic book movie ever made was The Iron Giant. Oh, everything about it was great.
He's right. Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or email us.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. Well, all week long, Judge Sonia Sotomayor has sat before the Senate Judiciary Committee in those confirmation hearings. They've been covered wall to wall, and Todd Zwillick has been there wall to wall from beginning to end for us, and Todd is back with us. Good morning, Todd.
Hey, John, good morning.
At the beginning of this confirmation hearings moment, and it is a historic moment, first Hispanic woman nominee, and she comes from the South Bronx. She's got a very compelling story, but it was a foregone conclusion that she would get confirmed. Any sense from yesterday that this is going to be anything other than a kind of a party line rubber stamp?
Well, you know, John, you say it was a foregone conclusion, but I never really believed that because anything can happen in these hearings. You know, go back to Robert Bork, go back to Clarence Thomas, who was confirmed in 1991, but there were signs, you know, that hearing veered off into Anita Hill land quite late.
Right.
And he almost got defeated. So
although Lindsey Graham said
very closely,
unless she melted down, Lindsey Graham said right at the top that there was no way she wasn't going to be confirmed.
Right. And with her, to borrow a phrase from our friend John Hodgman, her Spock-like calm carried her through these these entire hearings. She didn't give over any she really didn't betray any uncertainty. She didn't veer at all from sort of a strict legal constitutional interpretation for all the questions that she was asked, whether it was about the phrase that I promised not to say, which was wise Latina,
wise Latina phrase, yeah.
Right, wise Latina phrase, or any of the other things. But it is a foregone conclusion now because Republican leaders have come out and said quite certainly there will be no blocking of this and they will accede to a vote in early August, which gives Barack Obama, the president, and Harry Reid, the majority leader, their wish to have her confirmed before the August recess. So that looks like that's where we're headed.
And I said party line vote, but in fact, as you've just said there are Republicans who are definitely signaling that they're going to vote along with the Democrats. Let's talk about Lindsey Graham just for a moment. He began the week seeming pretty positive. Yesterday was testimony from people other than the nominee. Any sense that Graham has changed his tune at all?
There was a sense of that. The testimony yesterday, the most interesting testimony yesterday, some of it came from Frank Ricci of Ricci v. New Haven, the firefighters case.
Right.
And Republicans invited him. And when that happens, you're looking for the moment that they hope will galvanize support, perhaps, against the nominee. He's a sympathetic figure. He's a young guy who doesn't make a whole lot of money, just trying to get by. And this test, the New Haven firefighters test, he didn't get his promotion, even though he deserved it because of the case and really because of one of Sonia Sotomayor's decisions. Well, when it came time for Lindsey Graham to question Frank Ricci, and you wonder, you know, are they really going to go with the nominee? He really didn't. You know, Lindsey Graham has a tendency to lecture people, even though he can be quite entertaining. And I want to play a couple cuts. Listen to what he had to say to Frank Ricci when it came for the time to maybe attack the nominee.
I appreciate how difficult this is, must have been for you to bust your ass and to study so hard and to have it all stripped at the end. But I just want you to know as a country that we're probably one generation removed to where no matter how hard you studied, based on your last name or the color of your skin, you'd have no shot. And we're trying to find some balance.
Interesting. He's stepping away from Ricci. We should remind people in the Ricci case, the test was apparently in some way too hard, or I don't know what it is, but no African Americans passed the test, and so the local authorities decided that they wanted to throw it out and didn't promote the white firefighters who did pass the test, and that's what the issue was there. But there's
that's
Lindsey
right.
Graham
and
stepping
and
away.
At other points also, Lindsey Graham said, look, the American Bar Association has given her a highly qualified rating. Even Ken Starr sees a lot in this nominee. A lot of people do. Now, he never said, I'm going to vote for her. And he said,
right.
He said there are her speeches that, quote, bug the hell out of me. But he also said a lot of people see a lot in this nominee, and so do I. And so he edged right up to the line that he looks like he's going to support her.
All right, let's listen to Linda Chavez, who's a minority witness at the hearings, a conservative Hispanic woman who had some fairly tough criticism for Sonia Sotomayor. But let's see how it was received. First, here's Linda Chavez.
It is clear from her record that she has drunk deep from the well of identity politics. I know a lot about that well. And I can tell you that it is dark and poisonous. It is, in my view, impossible to be a fair judge and also believe that one's race, ethnicity, and sex should determine how someone will rule as a judge.
How did those sentiments go down in the hearing room, Todd Zwillick?
Well, it was really up to Lindsey Graham, once again, to respond to her. And I might have stepped on, you know, some cuts that we wanted to play, and I apologize for that. But that's what he said. He said to her, look, there's a lot about this nominee that bugs me, but you know, the ABA likes her, KenStar likes her, and I'm sorry, Ms. Chavez, but this is a qualified nominee. Right. He really didn't give her a lot of openings. Even though that's sort of why she was there. I think by the time it was the last panel, the last series of panels, which is where Chavez was with Frank Ricci, that it had become, John, what you call that foregone conclusion that these hearings were sort of over.
Well,
and the nominee was going to be confirmed.
Well, we'll see if it's a foregone conclusion. Todd Zwillick, distancing himself from me, of course. Takeaway Washington correspondent, responsible journalist. Have a great weekend, Todd.
We have talked and talked and talked about fixing health care for decades, and we have finally reached a point where inaction is no longer an option, where the choice to defer reform is nothing more than a decision to defend the status quo, and I will not defend the status quo. We are going to change health care reform.
It's Barack Obama speaking last night to a rousing crowd, but it was not at the NAACP convention in Manhattan. No, Barack Obama had some political emergency duties in the state of New Jersey that may have some national implications. Bob Henley, WNYC reporter, joins us right now to talk about the troubles for Democratic incumbent John Corzine, the governor of New Jersey. He's in trouble. And Bob Henley, first of all, what's going on and why?
Well, this is a senator-turned-governor. John Corzine, former chairman of the board of Goldman Sachs, had been a U.S. senator. Actually, John had actually picked Obama back when Corzine was head of the Democratic Campaign Committee, back when Obama was just an aspiring local personality in Illinois to run for this Senate. And then, of course, ironically, Corzine backs Clinton in the primary in New Jersey but has to count on the president coming to his rescue, because Corzine's down significantly, according to pollsters, in New Jersey against former U.S. Attorney Chris Christie, who made a reputation by putting a couple of hundred so-called corrupt politicians into jail.
Now, let's review the bidding. Of course, he's the governor of New Jersey and has spent, close to $100 million of his own money in two campaigns statewide in the state of New Jersey. It appears that he won't have the same resources because of the economy he's done really sort of badly in.
Well,
how has John Corzine fallen from grace in New Jersey, and how does Obama figure into this?
Well, I guess the thing here is that the downward decline for Corzine started in 2003 when he got divorced from his wife of some 30-some-odd years and gave her half of his pretty vast fortune that came out of his role of leading Goldman Sachs. Then on top of that, he came in, John, with really high expectations as an independently wealthy individual, much like Mayor Bloomberg, who was going to restore a new sense of fiscal order in New Jersey. We'd been through a lot of tumultuous times with Governor McGreevy, who, of course, had a lot of corruption problems, but also ended up leaving midterm when he admitted that he had an affair with a gay lover who he had appointed to a Homeland Security position the young man wasn't qualified for. So Corzine came in to kind of save the day and, unfortunately, just hasn't been able to get the reforms on the board. He had that tragic accident where he almost lost his life,
sure,
108 days out of office at one point. So he just hasn't been able to do it. So he needs Obama to come in. And, by the way, Obama's got a special connection with New Jersey. You know, that battle between Corzine, between Obama and Clinton back in the primary, brought,
sure,
600,000 new voters into the House in New Jersey for the Democrats.
And so, Corzine needs every single one of those. Can Obama save John Corzine? It's a long way till November, but he's way behind in the polls.
Let's put it this way. We have 17,000 people that showed up in the middle of a work day on the Garden State Parkway, packing the PNC Arts Center with a kind of rock star enthusiasm for the president, and Corzine thinks he'll be in the House come November.
Well, he better hope so, and you got to wonder if John Corzine wishes he was back at Goldman Sachs. He has spent, and I'm calculating here, $60 million of his own money in one campaign, $43 million more 4 years ago. Poor John Corzine. He has to actually raise money for his current campaign. Bob Henley reporting on John Corzine's troubles, the governor of New Jersey. We are asking you for a suggestion on what's your superpower, your favorite comic and comic book character, and what about comic book movie? Lala writes on our site, "My favorite graphic novels are by Adrian Tomine and Jessica Abel. but now superpowers, just great writing and drawing. That's what I love. Christopher from Windsor, Ontario, emails us, "My favorite has to be Aquaman. He's fundamentally useless, but can make it into the Justice League." Your suggestions at 8778-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here. Now, a story of corruption and heartbreak in suburban Chicago. Forensic scientists have begun picking over the remains of hundreds of cadavers desecrated in an alleged grave-selling plot at the historic Burr Oak Cemetery in Alsip, Illinois. Four workers at the cemetery have been arrested. Officials now estimate that close to 300 graves were tampered with. People in the community are just beginning to deal with the personal implications of all of this. We have two looks at this story, which has really rocked the Chicago area. Terry Dean joins us. He's had a family member buried in the Burr Oak Cemetery and is attempting to figure out what's going on. Terry, good morning.
Good morning.
And also with more of a big picture look at what it means to have a relative in a cemetery and our particular approach to death and burial in the United States is Gary Latterman, who's the author of Rest in Peace. He joins us from Emory University in Atlanta. Gary, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
First, Terry, what's personally happening in your family, since the news broke in Chicago of this shocking scam?
Well, it was actually my grandfather and uncle on my mother's side. She was watching the news, and she told the rest of the family that she had family members out there. And then come to find out that my grandfather on my father's side is also buried out there. The Cook County Sheriff's Office, they do have a hotline, which I called and just gave them the names. And I was told by, one of the sheriffs there that might take 2 weeks to find out, anything as far as what's going on with our family. I suspect it'll take a little bit longer. And, we're just like everybody else, shocked, upset, concerned, and really don't know what's going to happen.
Well, and it's so sad to think that, this kind of peaceful place in your heart, knowing that your family member was in a particular place that maybe you knew of, is now disrupted by this news event. But had your family actually paid to bury your members at the Burr Oak Cemetery?
Well, I'm the youngest of the family, so I don't have any memory of
sure.
Really either. So this happened, in the 70s. So, yeah, we went through the usual process, paid for the funeral, the burial plot. As I was telling my, sister, we weren't, frequent visitors to the cemetery, but it doesn't make a difference whether we went, once a week or, once every year or once every 10 years.
Or never. Never.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, that's the irony. That's the irony, Terry Dean. I mean, you can be devastated whether you visited the cemetery or not, right?
Exactly. I mean, this is, again, closure for us and everyone else. I mean, this is their resting place. And this is what's difficult to wrap my mind around this crime. I mean, who would think that you would have to check, not visit, but, check to make sure that your relatives are still there?
Right.
The fact that we've lost them once and now we've lost them again. We're not sure where our family members are. So it's really upsetting.
Well, Terry raises an interesting point for you, Gary Latterman, author of Rest in Peace at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. Culturally, we have this peculiar relationship with cemeteries and the notion of a resting place for human remains in our family. How has that been disrupted by this crime? And traditionally, are most people in this same situation of having a place that they can name on a map of where their relatives lie?
Sure, there's a long tradition in America and around the world generally of being having the expectation that where you dispose of the dead will be undisturbed. And, you know, that is a very powerful expectation that when it is disrupted, as it is in this case, as was mentioned, is devastating and really can throw people off and open up all kinds of wounds, as well as create all of this outrage.
The very nature of this transaction, though, I think sets up the scam, and not to say that it was obvious. I mean, you know, this isn't the kind of thing that happens every single day, but you are paying for this feeling that your loved ones are in a place that is permanent. And in fact, the fact that you're just paying for this feeling means that if people can duplicate that feeling in some dishonest way, they can make money.
And unfortunately, you know, there have been all kinds of scandals associated with the funeral industry and cemeteries throughout the years, based on the fact that you have these kinds of sacred connections with the dead that are embedded in a sort of larger area of commerce and consumerism. And sometimes people question that the very nature of those kinds of transactions when you're talking about religious feelings, religious investments, religious connections.
And is cremation growing for possibly this very reason in the United States?
You may remember a few years ago down here in Georgia, the Tri-State Crematory
right.
was another one of these scandals
exactly.
where people, you know,
yes.
the outrage from people when they realized that the caretaker, the people they, you know, turned over their dead to really were being irresponsible, if not, you know, sort of downright, you know, criminal.
And so the cemetery doesn't matter. No form of this sort of end is immune to this kind of abuse and corruption. Terry Dean, let's get a final word from you. Is there a place for your family to rest at Burr Oak, and has that been disrupted? And what are you thinking about your own personal plans?
Well, I know my father has said, and my parents are both seniors, so he said he wants to be cremated. As far as my own, well, not necessarily think of my own plans, but again, I think the main thing we want to do is find out where our relatives are. And I've even said that if there's any talk in the city about maybe closing the cemetery or, you know, relocating the, you know, people who are already there, I mean, I personally would oppose that. And I would just try to make sure that, again, if the bodies, you know, and other victims can't be retrieved, maybe some kind of memorial
right.
casket for each and every one of the victims that were disturbed to be placed there.
Well, Terry Dean, thanks so much for sharing your family's heartbreak with us. He has a family member, more than one family member, in Burr Oak Cemetery, subject of a scandal of corruption there in suburban Chicago. Terry, thanks for joining us from Oak Park, Illinois. And Gary Latterman, author of Rest in Peace, joined us from Emory University in Atlanta. And thanks to you, Gary. Headlines now from Femi Okeh.
Thanks, John. Just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. A positive economic indicator out this morning. The number of new houses built last month jumped 3.6%. That's its highest level in 7 months.
And the market futures have finally turned around. They're about to open, but it's going to be a positive opening, it looks like.
And probably actually something to do with Citigroup reporting second quarter earnings. Don't choke. Don't choke in the news. $3 billion after paying off dividends. And
okay,
that's instead of the big loss analysts expected and said with such sincerity, John.
Well, Peter Morici will be really happy.
Yes, I can see his bow tie there spinning in anger. The World Health Organization is planning to stop counting individual cases of H1N1, also known as swine flu. It says that countries trying to track individual cases are just being overwhelmed by the global pandemic. John.
Coming up, California's $26 billion deficit. There's an update, and we'll have it in just a moment. Thank you, Pam.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Look out, look out, look out, look out.
Good morning, everyone. Nine dead in Jakarta this morning. The big international story. Two explosions rocked the central business district. Two luxury hotels, both American-owned, the Ritz-Carlton and the JW Marriott. It's where the casualties were centered. The bombers are believed to actually have been staying in the hotel. Joining us now is Jim Della Giacoma, Southeast Asia Project Director in Jakarta for the International Crisis Group. Jim Della Giacoma, does this fit a pattern of bombings in this region, or does it stand alone in some way?
Well, in some ways, the events this morning are slightly different. In the past, we've seen a lot of vehicle-borne explosive devices or bombs, and indeed the last attack on the Marriott Hotel was a car bomb. And so this is slightly different, and as you just said, it appears that the security of the hotel has been breached, and that is something that we're waiting to find out more information about.
Is this a targeting, do you think, and again, we're speculating here, but still, is this a targeting, do you think, of the economic lifeblood of Indonesia, or is it more of a political target in the sense that tourists and possibly Westerners would be staying there, or is it a target because they're American-owned?
It's hard to tell, and as you said, it's a lot of speculation, but clearly these are high-profile targets. They're in very much the geographic center of Jakarta and the commercial center of Jakarta, so it may be targeted for all sorts of reasons, but if the terrorists were seeking to gain maximum publicity or attention for their act, and they have been very successful at that.
The Jemaah Islamiyah group, which has been known to target attacks like this in this particular region, no sign of them so far. What's the next step?
Well, it's too early to tell who was responsible, and while there have been many reports and fingers pointed at JI, I think the president himself said that until a proper investigation is done, everybody should be careful about pointing fingers and making accusations. There are a number of other splinter groups and small radical groups in Indonesia that may have been responsible, but it's quite difficult to tell from the modus operandi or the no other information or claims of responsibility, so it's very difficult to point the end of the finger at any particular group.
Well, investigators are focused on that tragedy. Jim Della Giacoma, Southeast Asia Project Director in Jakarta for the International Crisis Group. At least eight dead, dozens injured at bombings at two luxury hotels in Jakarta, timed right after the election in the country, but government officials are saying there's no evidence there's any connection between the two. Shifting gears now to the West Coast, California is still printing money. Well, not actually money. It's IOUs, the budget deficit and the budget shortfall. $26 billion in California is still affecting operations in that state. Patricia Nazario is joining us from public radio station KPCC in Pasadena, California. Patricia, thanks for being with us. And how come this budget standoff, which could have been resolved yesterday, wasn't?
The main issue now is that they are trying to decide how to tweak, basically squeeze $11 billion out of some funding that's supposed to be appropriated to public schools here in California. So it's the public elementary system and then the junior college system we have here. And this is a proposition, Proposition 98, that voters put into effect. And any time that happens, it's supposed to go back before the voters for any changes. So what politicians in Sacramento are trying to do is trying to see how they can tweak it, carve around it, and basically squeeze $11 billion out of it and contribute that back into the general fund. But it's a sticking point because the Democrats want to be sure schools get that money back, and they want Schwarzenegger, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, to say that in writing, and he's reluctant to do that.
All right. As the standoff continues, though, schools still have to make program cuts and prepare for what looks like a very difficult back-to-school fall, correct?
And it's been that way all summer. I mean, they've already cut summer school classes, and there are already some layoffs happening at school. So, yeah, it's been tough even as school was ending for summer break.
Who takes the political hit if there is chaos in the public schools in the big districts around the state come fall? Is it the legislature generally, or is it the governor?
Well, I think in this case, it will probably be the governor. The California Teachers Association has already started some ads, some pretty in-your-face ads. They've launched this month. They spent $1 million on this campaign blasting Schwarzenegger on his record on public school funding and how poor it has been in his term.
And is there a pro-education constituency, and does it run across party lines, or is it pretty much the Democrats and the teachers' union fighting the governor head-to-head?
I think outside of Sacramento, there is definitely more of a presence for schools in Sacramento. State Superintendent of Public Instruction Jack O'Connell wants, of course, to preserve the budget. I mean, Proposition 98 was designed exactly for this reason, so that schools wouldn't be attacked and wouldn't be poached for when the state is going through a crisis, you know, to further to help politicians further their goals. But, you know, what's happening now in California is that, you know, the deficit has really sunk the state so much, and it is in such a lull that Proposition 98 didn't really address this scenario. So there really is some wiggle room. But I think, you know, you have O'Connell on one end and teachers union saying, hey, but wait a minute, this is what we want. This is what voters wanted. And we have a right to try and preserve this money, or at least if we poach it now to create a way so that the schools can be reimbursed this money going forward when the state is in better condition.
Well, poaching, you make a good point. That guarantee may turn out to be as dubious as Prop 98 if the reimbursement guarantees are voted. When you're $26 billion down, it's really tough politically to prevent sacrificial lambs everywhere you look. Patricia Nazario, reporter for KPCC in Pasadena, California. Thanks so much. And now headlines with Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much. 22 minutes to the top of the hour. Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor is on track for a full Senate confirmation vote on the first week in August. She's finished with her confirmation hearings. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham told her yesterday that he believes she can disengage from her own personal beliefs on the Second Amendment.
Fundamentally, Judge, you're able, after all these years of being a judge, to embrace a right that you may not want for yourself.
Sotomayor is expected to gain votes from some Republican senators and all of the Democrats. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton will be in India, part of an Asian trip that also takes her to Thailand. It's her first overseas visit since breaking her elbow last month, and she says there will be more travel after she gets back.
I wonder if that's the first time that's ever been said in the history of Secretary of State's first foreign trip since breaking her elbow.
It could be a first. Meanwhile, 11 civilians were killed in a roadside bombing today in southern Afghanistan. This comes as a British soldier died in another explosion. And a suspected U.S. missile strike in northwest Pakistan has left at least five alleged militants dead. Back at home, Hollywood editors are working to digitally sharpen up copies of Apollo 11 footage.
Why?
Well, because NASA, the original live TV transmission, they had it on tape and then they erased over the tape to save money.
No.
They recycled.
It never happened.
Back in 1969.
It happened in Hollywood. It's a
recycling
fake.
Was
it
in.
Was fake. They never went to the moon.
So remember the.
Haven't you heard that?
Remember Casablanca? The version they touched
on. On a Hollywood set.
Same people doing
they
that.
Erase the tape.
They're
sure.
Working on this.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
There's a slumber place.
Possibly the cheesiest movie of all time, A Summer Place. But summer used to not be so much about giant special effects and aliens attacking planet Earth. It used to be about romantic movies, movies that take you back or move you forward or cause you to maybe hold hands in a dark theater. In the middle of the summer, it seems like that movie for 2009 is 500 Days of Summer. It's not the season, but the girl named Summer.
So you have a boyfriend?
No. Who needs it? We're young, might as well have fun while we can.
And wait, what happens if you fall in love?
You don't believe that, do you?
What? It's love, it's not Santa Claus.
Kind of dark, kind of Gen XYZ, you pick the letter. It's a nerdy boy meets beautiful girl flick, and here to talk about it is David Edelstein, chief film critic for New York Magazine. David, thanks so much for taking this romantic track for the summer.
Well, you know, it's actually a pretty depressing movie. It's not the greatest date movie in the world. You said a nerd and a beautiful woman. If anything, the lesson is that nerds should not maybe go out with extremely beautiful women because when they get dumped, they never get over it.
So it's a Scarred for Life movie, it's kind of a seasonal Scarred for Life movie. So, but these are incredible performances.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the problem I had with the movie is that Zoe Deschanel, who is, you know, incredibly beautiful and has those electric blue eyes, she's a little bit remote and unknowable. That's the movie's position. It's entirely presented from the point of view of this nerdy guy who's absolutely smitten and would like to basically move in with her, you know, the first time they hang out together.
And the guy is played by?
Joseph Gordon-Levitt, an extremely wonderful actor who got his start actually in a sitcom, Third Rock from the Sun, and immediately moved on to playing a gay hustler, and as well as a brain-damaged hero of a movie called The Lookout.
The fourth Rock from the Sun is gay hustler, yeah.
I think so. And then he's moving out in the solar system, as it were. And he's a really exciting actor. He's sort of he's a bit of a tabula rasa. You can project things onto him that you like. You don't catch him acting. But he's kind of like a more soulful Keanu Reeves. He's got a kind of beautiful face in his way. And, Keanu can seem just like an android, whereas I think with Joseph Gordon-Levitt, you always think that there's something going on in his head.
The thing that surprised me about this movie is that from the point of view of the nerdy guy, you're almost trying to fuse maybe Catcher in the Rye with the Apatow, where you've got a sort of a nerdy, goofy, not necessarily loving point of view, taking a classic story.
Apatow usually has a little bit sunnier and more romantic
And laughs.
Ending. Yeah, yeah. Right. Whereas this movie really is sort of steeped in melancholy. And it also, I think it's very, you know, its content is very ordinary. What makes it so interesting and entertaining is the syntax. It starts, if you pardon my French, on day 243, and it jumps back to day 1, and then it jumps to day 10. And you have this wonderful play of you see the relationship budding, but you also see its ending and its aftermath and all the ugly stuff. And they're kind of juxtaposed together in a way that's actually, you know, very funny and surprising.
Well, that's great. But I guess the narrative that Hollywood's interested in is Joseph Gordon-Levitt qualify as the next big thing. You've got 10 seconds.
Absolutely. He's got amazing range, and I think that's what's going to save him from any particular niche.
Well, great, great. Something to look forward to there. David Edelstein, chief film critic for New York Magazine and Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining whether states have the right to legislate the foods and restaurants that people choose. Is it a responsible way to make communities healthier, or does it violate freedom of choice? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Coming up, imagining a second 100 years for the NAACP. But first, Femi Oke has some headlines.
Thanks, John. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. We are just getting some news in from the Takeaway's man in Washington, Todd Zwillick. Morning, Todd. And the news is that Republican Senator Richard Lugar just announced that he will be voting for Sonia Sotomayor. It looks like she may get some other Republican votes as well as a whole bunch of Democratic ones. An early August vote in the full Senate is likely. New home construction is at its highest level in a full 7 months. The 3.6% jump is higher than forecasters expected. And staying with some business news, two more mega banks are out with some large profit reports, continuing the week's theme. Bank of America and Citigroup both posted multi-billion dollar profits in the second quarter, surpassing analysts' expectations. And finally, just looking at some international news for you, Iranian opposition protesters are recovering from new clashes with government security forces. They rallied at prayer services today. That's a look at top stories from this morning's news, John.
Thank you, Femi. So yesterday, the NAACP wrapped up its convention. It had a lot to celebrate, aside from 100 years of anniversary. It celebrated its first African-American president. And Barack Obama spoke last night and outlined a second 100 years for the NAACP.
On the 200th anniversary of the NAACP, let it be said that this generation did its part, that we too ran the race, that full of faith, that our dark past has taught us, full of the hope that the present has brought us, we faced in our lives and all across this nation the rising sun of a new day begun. Thank Thank you. God bless you. God bless the United States of America.
Barack Obama speaking last night here in New York at the NAACP convention. A vigorous conversation on the Takeaway website continues about the relevance and importance of the NAACP down through the years. On thetakeaway.org, you can hear from a woman who helped form an NAACP chapter in Franklin County, Tennessee 50 years ago. It's all about her battle to desegregate the local school there. All those sorts of stories speak to the relevance of the NAACP over the last century. But what about in the future? Joining us now, John McWhorter, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and adjunct professor at Columbia University. His latest book is Our Magnificent Bastard Tongue, The Untold Story of English. Professor, good morning.
Good morning.
Is there a legitimate question to ask, does the NAACP have relevance a century from this moment on?
Well, yeah, there is a question along those lines, and I really hope it does. But if it were up to me, the NAACP would refashion its mission. The issue is not whether there needs to be a National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. The question is just what advancement is now in 2009 versus what it was in 1909 or even 1959 or 1969. I'm not sure that I see among the current leadership of the NAACP an engagement with the fact that times are not perfect by any means, but they've changed and deeply.
And why does that necessarily mean that the organization goes away? Does the existence of the organization suggest that those changes haven't been made? Or is there a language, a message from the organization that can actually roll with the times here, in your view?
Well, the language, I think, needs to be that what's going on now are things in the black community that need to be fixed in terms of social services and in terms of guidance. And what the NAACP was for originally was something that was very urgent 100 years ago, which was combating racism and discrimination.
Well, combating and lynching, actually, was the
for
first.
For example.
The first,
yeah. Yeah, and all sorts of things. And I think there's a sense nowadays that until there is no such thing as what you would call racism or discrimination at all, then the NAACP needs to be focused on that. And what worries me is that we're at a point where certainly racism and discrimination exist. Open your newspaper every week. But the question is whether that's still the main issue in a suffering black community. I don't think it is. And my dream is that the NAACP refocuses efforts on what are today the main problems in the black community and how to fix them.
Well, Barack Obama seems to think that there is a role for the NAACP, even though he said last night in his speech that, in fact, the discrimination is better. There's a long way to go. And he also specifically talked about not so much the NAACP will stay here until the last person is not discriminated against. He didn't really talk in those terms, but he did say the NAACP should have a leadership role in broadening the agenda to anti-discrimination against gays, anti-discrimination against people who worship a different religion, people who are Muslims, French. He used mm-hmm. that explicitly. Do you think the NAACP is capable of that? And if that is that a useful mission?
I think that the NAACP is highly capable of that. I think that that is where their inclinations will most naturally flow, and I think that those efforts would be a good thing. But here, in brief, is what I mean. Later today, I'm going to be doing an interview right. on what's beginning to be called the black unemployment crisis. And certainly, there are black people, especially young ones, who are having trouble finding jobs. And in many cases, what the issue is teaching the people in question what you need to do to get the kinds of training, to get particular kinds of jobs that many people don't think very much about. You know, you can make a great deal of money, a thoroughly middle-class existence, for example, being one of the people who fixes air conditioners and heaters. You don't think about that when you're out on the street. That, to me, is very important. And when you listen to Barack Obama yesterday talking about how, yes, things are not perfect, yes, racism exists, but you can't let that be an excuse, to me, that is the most important aspect of the message, because concretely, the way that you can follow his advice after you get over the beautiful black cadence and how stirring the speech was, what he means is that an NAACP needs to teach people how to get jobs in a society where they're not falling into your lap anymore.
So that's the rhetoric. So the rhetoric of you don't want to aspire to be LeBron, you want to aspire to be Barack.
Lil Wayne, right.
Or Lil Wayne, you want to be Barack Obama. Actually, you would say a better phrase would be, don't aspire to be LeBron, aspire to be an air conditioner repairman.
You know what? Yes, because if you actually talk to an air conditioner repairman about what kind of money they make, you don't have to have gone to Princeton to do that. Talk about something else in the headlines today, which is the funding that Barack Obama is giving to community colleges. That's what that's all about. That is race-targeted legislation in its way. And I think
is that wrong?
I think that's wonderful, and I think that we lose sight of that. that if, say, the NAACP continues to focus on discrimination as the main meal.
Does the NAACP and its emotional connection to Barack Obama handicap African Americans in being critical of the economic program out of Washington, in that they're going to hang with Barack Obama even if the deliverables don't come down to perhaps the most victimized group in the United States regarding unemployment?
Well, you know something? I would say that there is a danger of that, especially if what the NAACP is most interested in when they wake up in the morning is trying to find out where, somewhere, a black person is being discriminated against, which is always interesting. But once you fought that fight, like, for example, the one going on right now about subprime loans.
It's not just interesting. I mean, it's illegal.
Sure, it's illegal. But what about the people who are standing on corners who don't know what kind of job opportunities are available to them? I want our national organization to be as interested in that as in the other things.
So if you got a call today, we talked with Ben Jealous, the head of the NAACP, who talked about jobs, talked about the economics, talked to a lot of people this week, Van Jones, who's in the White House doing this. If you got a call today saying, John, get over here. We've got a design project to actually get the air conditioner repairman training program going. Would you say, sure, I'm coming? Or would you say, leave me alone? I don't believe it for a minute.
No, I would be right on the train going. I've actually gotten a call rather like that. And what's interesting is that there's what the NAACP does talk about doing. And I think that they're sincere in this. This happens every year at every convention. But then when you look 6 months later, it's hard to see what they were prominently doing as opposed to the things they were doing before. I hope that might change.
Lonnie Guinier said on this program yesterday that organizations like the NAACP aspire to go out of existence. Now, you didn't hear much of that from Barack Obama last night, that that the mission for their existence should be to go away, to no longer be needed. Do you take that literally?
Well, I think that everyone knows that intellectually, but as long as there's an idea that when the organization in its original mission was no longer needed is, like as you said, when there is no longer a black person standing who can claim any kind of discrimination, then I think that we're in trouble, because what actually happens is there's a transitional point where there's discrimination,
right.
Then there are other things that are equally urgent.
So John McWhorter, you're senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, incredibly articulate, great professor, distinguished writer, yet you got to have had an emotional twinge last night listening to that speech.
Oh, of course. It was one of his best ones. And to see him putting forth a message that I agreed with completely, including, despite whatever my reputation might be, and understanding that discrimination exists, it was wonderful to see that message done in a style that would communicate with any black person.
Well, thanks so much for being with us, John McWhorter, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, adjunct professor at Columbia. His latest book, Our Magnificent Bastard Tongue, The Untold Story of English. Full coverage for the entire week of our NAACP centennial coverage is at thetakeaway.org. And we're breaking in our spandex suits here at The Takeaway, getting ready for next week's Comic-Con conference starting in San Diego. We want to know what's your favorite comic and favorite character.
Hey, my name is Eric. I'm calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. And I would say that my favorite superhero would have to be Power Man. He was the first black superhero, and he was somebody that I could identify with.
My name is Stephanie, and I'm calling from New Rochelle. My favorite superhero character is Storm from the X-Men. She's beautiful, and she's powerful.
That's all from me, Radio Man, here at The Takeaway. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. It's all at our website. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. See ya.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.